I wanted to talk a little bit about something that was, I mentioned to some people that there was a person who I felt a little bad. There was someone I knew about, I don't know, about 35 years ago, and I was not in touch with him. He was just Nifter this week, Reb Nosson Shulman. I feel bad I lost touch with him. He's a very, very chashuv person. So I wanted to say something over from him.
Who is he?
It was like this. There was a person called the Alter Salbaka. Right? You heard the Alter Salbaka. Okay. The Alter Salbaka had a son-in-law. What was his son-in-law's name?
Rabbi Isaac Sher.
Rabbi Isaac Sher became the Shiva Salbaka after the Alter left Salbaka. Rabbi Isaac Sher had a son-in-law. What was his name? Okay, you're half right. His son's name was Mordechai Shulman. I think the yeshiva has a book about him. There's yeshiva, something. It's in the English library. Are you shaking your head?
Yeah.
Mordechai Shulman. Mordechai Shulman, I remember a little bit. He used to come to America. He was very close to, I don't know, certain people. Mordechai Shulman, it says in the Kaskama to the Chidush Alev, that when Rav David was sick, Rav Mordechai Shulman gave Shir Min Chafetz Chaim, just for the record, because he was stuck in America during World War II. And he actually was living in Rav David's house, I think. So he was, when Rav David was sick, he gave Shir Min Chafetz Chaim. So Rav Mordechai Shulman was Rav Isaac Shir's son-in-law. So after World War II, Mordechai Shulman and Rav Isaac Sher both survived the war, different reasons. So they reestablished Salbaka in Bnei Brak. Right? There are two Salbakas in Eretz Israel. There's Salbaka in Yerushalayim and Salbaka in Bnei Brak. Right?
Both called Salbaka?
No. The one in Yerushalayim is called what?
Chevron.
Right? Because what happened was that the Alter himself started a branch in Israel in the 1920s. And that was, they started in Chevron. So the Salbaka in Yerushalayim is called Chevron. But the Salbaka in Europe, who was Rashiva, was Rav Isaac Sher. So after the war, he reestablished it in Bnei Brak. Just a fascinating thing, which has nothing to do with the Musar Vat, but a fascinating thing, as long as we're schmoozing, for the Musar Vat. We went to visit this Rav Mordechai Shulman in 1977. So when the whole yeshiva was in Israel, Sukkot's time. So he taught us a very, very fascinating thing that we were sort of discussing. I don't know how he asked it, because I don't think I have so much chutzpah to ask it straight. That whether Salbaka and Bnei Brak does not really follow Salbaka Musar. So the question is, why not? So, I don't know how we asked it. It was a long time ago. I don't remember. So, he told us a fascinating thing. He told us that one part of the reason is he felt that, you know, the hashpa of being in Bnei Brak, you can't really run a yeshiva. He says, in Europe, Sabak was an isolated city, so they could do what they want. But in Bnei Brak, there's hashpa of the neighborhood. But he said a much more fascinating thing. He said, in his opinion, the biggest problem why he can't really be mashpia on his bachrim is because they get married very young. So he says, they come in the yeshiva till they, you know, before they're 17, 18, they're too young. They don't come in the down the yeshiva. They come in the yeshiva. In Israel, 21, you're already married. So it's like there's no time to really mold the Talmud. In Europe, they got married, face, much later, 30. I don't know what time they got. So the Salbaka, the Alter, had time to mold the Talmidim into, you know, into the personality they wanted. But in Israel, they get married very young.
Okay. So we have the same problem.
No, we don't get
married at 30.
Okay, but not still. And he said, why do they get married so young? So, okay, maybe getting married at 30 is not right. You're not supposed to get married at 30. But 21, why do they get married at 21? So it could be there were some gedolim that held you should. But apparently he was not of that liking. He said, how come in Israel the minhag became that they got married so young? So he said a fascinating thing. He said it used to be the minhag in Israel was they used to get married late. 23, 24, 25, whatever. Not late, okay, 25, okay. But what happened? He says, those who know your Israeli history, in the early 50s or late 40s, Israeli government passed a bill called Giyas Banos. Right, what is Giyas Banos? Drafting girls. Israel was one of the only countries in the world, that might still be the only, that drafts girls, mandatory draft for girls. Now, the reason why they were drafting girls is not people because Israel was in such a attack by the Arabs, it was so dangerous, because until recently, when, you know, maybe now it's starting to change because of women's lives, women were never allowed to be in combat units, and even in Israel. So they were just doing office work, whatever. They were not really serving much function in the army. But the main reason for the draft was that they wanted to mold the Israeli personality. They wanted to take, basically, this was the, you know, they started the country, they had this dream of making an Israeli personality, get rid of the godless Jewish personality. So the idea was you draft the kids and you put them in a new environment and you can mold them. So be that as it may, the Chazon Ish came out that drafting girls going to the army is Yehari Gal Yavar. Now, I'm not coming to get into this issue. But that's what the Chazon Ish baskened, that for a girl to go, for a boy, he didn't say so, but for a girl, especially it's a mixed army, it's preetzes, it's your supervisor is a non-religious man who can boss you around and order you, and the whole atmosphere is there's a lot of preetzes in the army. So he passed the Harvey Yavar. So, but the government was very much, they wanted to draft the girls. So the government said, well, listen, you know, if you don't draft it, we're going to arrest you. What would you prefer, be in jail with a bunch of criminals or be in the army? You know, being in jail also not so good. And the Chazon Ish said they can't go. So people were mamish on shpokas because it was a game of what you would call chicken, like who's going to blink first. The government said, if you don't come to register for the army, we're coming in tomorrow and we're arresting all the girls. Chazon Ish said, the girls are not allowed to go. So who blinked first? The Maisa Ben Gurion blinked first, right? Obviously, he backed down. But the Maisa, he said there was like about 3 months or so when no one knew who was going to give in. And they were always petrified that the Israeli government was going to come in one day and just arrest all the girls because they were against the law. They weren't going to the army. So there was one way to get out of the draft. What was that?
Get married.
So basically, he said, during the 3 month period when everyone was petrified, all the 18-year-old girls were quickly getting married. Now, if you get married, all of a sudden, when you're 18, 17, they were quickly marrying him off. You got to marry him off to someone. So he says, and especially the girl age went down, so the boy's age went down. So he said what happened was that they basically, in this 3 month period, the age of marriage went down. Some, you know, people got to get married young because it was a big push. Got to marry off the girls. We need shidduchim. We got to marry off the girls. So he says, and then even though Ben Gurion stopped, changed his mind, and decided he wasn't going to draft the girl. Now there's a law that from girls are exempt from the army, basically. And they changed the law, but it became once it was it became a minhag, you couldn't stop it anymore. So that, when I thought that was like such an amazing Musar thing, because why is it so amazing Musar thing? Because here he's saying, I can't run my yeshiva the way I want to. Why not? Because in 1950, for 3 months, the people started getting married younger, and that changed the whole climate, and therefore I can't run the yeshiva the way I want to run it. Okay? Isn't that a fascinating thing? You don't like it, no. What is a Mutzer Haskel? What's the point? I'm getting off on a complete tangent, but okay. The point is that sometimes little things have major, you don't even realize it. You know, little, it's like some stupid thing that happened because of the draft caused that he can't run his yeshiva the way he wants to run it. It changed the whole course of history. Sometimes a little thing can change the course of history. Right? And then we get to our Musar V'ayin. Okay, there's a vort in the Sefer. Now I'm not sure if this is a true story or a make believe story. It's written in the Sefer where I saw it as a make believe story, and then it was written over in a different Sefer as a true story. So I can't tell you, but it's the same idea. That how did World War I break out? So he said that what happened was, in this Sefer, it brings as follows, that the Russians had called up their troops, and the Russian troops were on the border with the German troops. And they were I think it was Russian, German. And there was a lot of tension, and, you know, because whatever happened, and So the German foreign minister called on his secret phone the Russian foreign minister that, listen, we got to calm things down, you know. This is, you know, it's not, you know, Chas v'Shalom, a war might break out, you know. You know, they both called up their army. But meanwhile, he says, as Mazo, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu had it, right before the Russian foreign minister, he loved fish. And he had it brought to him to the front, his own private cook, to cook him fish, supper meals. And the cook had just burnt the special fish that he brought to him to make. And just when he comes, finds out that the cook has burnt his fish, and he screamed at the cook, the phone rings, his secret phone, and it's a German prime minister, whatever it is, foreign minister, to tell him that we have to keep this thing, you know, calm, that it shouldn't explode. So, of course, he's in a bad mood, so he screams at the German foreign minister, too, and basically hangs up the phone on him, and the Germans decide this is a bad sign, we see what's coming, so they basically attack, and that's how World War I started. That's what he wrote. Now, he said, this might not have really happened, but it could have happened. The other person said it really did happen. I don't know. I assume it didn't really happen. But it could. There's little things you never know. Little trivia things. Anyway, that's what Rav Shem Mordechai Shimon said. I kind of want to get off too many things. I'm stalling for time. So that's what Rav Mordechai Shimon. Rav Mordechai Shimon was a very, very big gadol. He was like, together with Rav Shach, they were like the Steiper were like the three oldest gadolim in Bnei Brak. So when Rav Mordechai Shulman, his oldest son, I don't know, Madron, his only son, as far as I know, he had a son, was Rav Nosson Shulman. This was the one who was just Nifter. So Rav Nosson Shulman was a son, and then he also had Rav Mordechai Shulman had some Russian daughters. So when Rav Mordechai Shulman died, the son, Rav Nosson Shulman, was supposed to become the Shiva Salbaka. Salbaka is the next to Shpanovich, is the largest yeshiva in Bnei Brak. So Rav Nosson Shulman came to America because for about a year, maybe over a year, because he said that his father had the whole Salbaka office in his head. His father was brilliant, but he didn't write down. So when his father died, they lost contact with all their donors. So he spent a year in America to try and reestablish the Salbaka office. So he was in America, that was around, I don't know, 78. So he used to come around the yeshiva. I used to go visit him, whatever. So he used to. So I got to know him. Okay. Anyway, so what did he do? He first came to America. He rented an apartment. I'm pretty sure in Williamsburg, cheap little, you know, one room. And then he had an einfau that he wants to go ahead and reestablish a Sabako office. You're not going to reestablish a Sabako office by living in Williamsburg. So what did he do? He rented an apartment in a very high-class, expensive neighborhood, somewhere in the Upper West Side, but in some very fancy neighborhood. And he davened in the fancy shul with all the rich people. And that's how he reestablished the Sabako office, because he spent the whole week with all these rich people. So he told me a gevaldige gevart. He told me that there is a chazal that says that there is a certain person who, that he was just as much, the chazal is coming to praise a certain person, that he paid just as much attention to like a penny and to a million, $1,000 or $1 million, he treated it the same. He worked hard to get a penny, and he worked hard for $1 million. That's something like that. I don't remember the lashon. I don't remember. So he says the most people learn pshat. What's the shvach for the person? So most people learn pshat. The shvach is that he worked so hard for the penny. Okay, for $1 million, of course he worked hard. But he thought and he cared about the penny. That's the shvach. He says, no, he doesn't think that's pshat. This was Rav Shmuel, he was like a super genius, so he always had these brilliant things to say. He says, of course, if we're for every yeshiva, you go to any yeshiva, they worry about pennies. Mum and Hegdish, you got to worry about pennies. You can't waste a penny of Hegdish, you have no right. Skineva, right? Yeshiva has, you know, you can't just, even though a lot of things they do here, but it's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Guy, you know, it's Hegdish money, you don't have to waste Hegdish money. So, of course, you have to worry about a penny. The shvach is that usually that's what you do all day. You worry about pennies because you don't have too many opportunities, $1 million. If you're running a yeshiva, you got lots of opportunities to worry about pennies. Turn off the lights, turn off the air conditioner. Do you lock up the milk? Put away the cereal, right? Don't let guys have more than one cup of milk a day, or whatever it is. You know, all the things you do to save, to cut courses, to cut your pennies. He says, you mutcher a guy for tuition for an extra 3 hours, you know, whatever it is. He says, you get so used to running after the penny that when an opportunity comes to make $1 million, you don't even notice it. Because when you're in the mode of pennies, you can't think about $1 million, right? If you're all day worrying about saving pennies, then you can't switch focus and think about how to make $1 million. It's not in the creativity of your brain, because your brain isn't thinking about that. Your brain is, you become a small-minded person. So the goddess of this Amora was that even though he spent all day obviously worrying about pennies, he did become a small-minded person, and he was able to seek out the opportunities also for $1 million. Right? He got the shot. That's the shot. So he said it about himself, that the people look at him, what? You're spending, I don't know how much the rent was in this place, you know? You can get yourself a cheap apartment in Williamsburg, you know, where he was before, and you're taking yeshiva money, and you're spending it in this fancy apartment. I shouldn't have said, you know, that probably was nothing in the neighborhood that he went to move into. There was no such thing as a cheap apartment. You know, you're wasting yeshiva money. He says most people wouldn't even dawn on them. He's like, I can't do such a thing. It's not just that they would discount it. They wouldn't even dawn on them the option. He says I don't want to say praising himself, but he was saying, defending himself, you know, that's, you can't let yourself become small-minded. You got to go after the $1 million. You want $1 million. If I can raise $1 million by making a contact with somebody, this rich kvir, it's worth all the pennies many, many times over. So people that make their living worrying about the pennies and then they lose the track that that's not really what counts. What counts is to make the $1 million. So he did, you have to worry about the penny. You're not allowed to ignore the pennies. But at the, you can't allow it to cause your mind to be stifled. That was what he thought. I thought it was a very enlightening thing. Anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about. How do we go ahead to become, run after the $1 million, right? In other words, this problem that he's mentioning, that we are very big on Zahiris, and we don't do the, not to do the Averis, Shadosh, Be'ikvav, and not to do, you know, and we, we're, you know, we become also, that's what you're supposed to, Hashkafa, Musar. You have to be every careful from every little thing, and not a word of Bittul Torah. You know, okay, I don't know if we're saying this or that, but, you know, but we're supposed to, right? And you're supposed to be Nizer in all the, so what is the danger? The danger is that we want, you know, Lahavdil Elav Avos. You got this guy, his name is what, Trump, right? How did he become president? Did he have any qualifications to be president? Probably not. So how did he become president? Because he decided he wants to be president. Now, part of the amazing chiddush is that he dreamed, I want to become president. Okay, he's a super about guy, et cetera, but still, he's not crazy. He's a smart guy, you know? Most people would never, you know, you would never, that's what he was saying, just Rav Shulman. Just like most people, I don't know any millionaires. I came from Israel. I only speak Hebrew. I don't speak a word of English. I don't have any contacts. Right? All the contacts of Sopoka Yeshiva were forgotten. I know no one in America, except he knew the Rosh Yeshiva. Okay, but that wasn't very good help for fundraising. Right? He knows no one in America. He's going to raise millions of dollars. Like, you're crazy. How are you going to raise millions of dollars? Right? So he had this dream. He figured it out. He's going to move into a rich neighborhood and live there for a few months, maybe a year, and dive in the shul, and he'll make $1 million. So that's the same thing. You know, the ability to dream big is such an important thing, because one big $1 million is worth more than $1 million pennies, right? $1 million is even worth more than $1 million pennies, 100 times more, right? Got your math. And most people in their lifetime don't make $1 million pennies. Rabbi Trapper told me years ago, there was, you know, there used to be Rabbi Ben Sion Chait, I don't know if people know him anymore. He was the founding Rosh Hashiva here. And the Rosh Hashiva, that's how, basically pulled him to be in charge of the, what's it called, the Queens, what's
global
it called?
Network.
What?
Global network.
Not the global network, what's that, what it's called?
Development.
Okay, development.
Director of development.
Now, Rabbi Chait was very happy here. He had no desire to leave, and he was very important here. He was serving a very big role. So, like, it was a little bit like, why you need Rabbi Chait for? Why pull a person who was happy and settled? And wasn't like Rabbi Chait came to Rashiva. Rashiva came to him. Like, why did the Rashiva put like, I don't want to say he twisted his arm, but he did, you know, very strong encouragement. You know, why did he, not like there are other guys in Yeshiva. We have a whole Queens graduating, so many Musmachim, and there are plenty of people that could use the jobs, and, you know, what do you want with Rabbi Chait? Like, Rabbi Chait is happy, he's successful, and he's functioning, and he's, you know, the yeshiva needs him. So Rabbi Trapper told me, because Rabbi Chait is a dreamer. He said, Rabbi Chait has an amazing kayach of being a dreamer. He says, Rashiva Dehird, the Rabbi Chait of, I don't say of all the people, but yeah, basically. He says, Rabbi Chait came to Miami. He started with, what, 6 students. Right? He was a dreamer. He came down, and he, not only was he a dreamer that he could envision, he got so excited, he was a dreamer who could get other people excited about his dream. He could come to a place that there's nothing there and dream of a yeshiva with hundreds of students and convince the Baal Batim that the dream is real. It's an amazing kaya. So he said, most people could never do that. They come to a place, they're going to build the yeshiva here, but there's nothing here. And if you're not excited about it, you'll never convince to get it going. You know, there has to be the leader. The leader, it's not necessarily that the dreamer has to be the biggest. I remember Rabbi Trapper said like this, that in any major company, the head of the company, you'll have people that are geniuses, and you have people that are in the, but the head of the company will not be the most qualified person. There'd be someone in IBM, there's someone, definitely someone that's much smarter than the guy who's the president of IBM or whatever, Apple, believe it or not. Any other thing. The goddess of the head of the president of Apple was that he was a dreamer. He could dream up these. And then he would call up his guy and says, listen, you figure out how to do it. You know, I can't figure out how to do it. I just got this dream. I want a phone that will do this and this. That's this crazy dream. I want a mobile phone. Okay, you're a brilliant computer programmer. Make it for me. But the guy, to have the dream and to believe in the dream, he says, this guy couldn't do it. That's why he's not the boss. He's only a worker. The president was like, so there's an amazing chaos of being able to dream. Anyway, that's what I want to talk about. The question is, that Ezra Hashem, we want to be accomplish great things with our lives. I think we all want to accomplish great things. Not to be president. We don't want to be president of the United States. We have no desire to be the president of the United States. Right? I don't know about anyone else. But I have no desire to be the president of the United States. So that's not necessarily accomplishing something great. But there are great things that a priesthood can accomplish. It doesn't have to be great, can be very, very, you know, there are many definitions of great. There's a lot of room. Great could be a great family. Great could be a great, you know, great mitzvah. Great could be, who knows, a lot of things. The question is, in order to do that, sometimes you have to be able to get out of the little, we lock ourselves in on, you know, on our daily lives, and we don't see the opportunity, right? I brought up Chumash. It's a little bit in this week's parasha, last week's parasha. Where is it in last week's parasha? Who can figure this out? But maybe it's gedarshened, but I don't know if it's so gedarshened. It says, I'm not saying it's a mukhruch shmuz. It says when Abraham sent away, what was his name? Yishmael. So with Hagar. So what happened? So she went to the midbar, and the water ran out. So what'd she do? She threw the baby under the bush, and she basically sat there crying, whatever, because she said, I don't want to see the child die. And she started to cry. So what does it say? So the pasuk says, Vayifkach Elokim Eseinah, Hashem opened her eyes, Vatera Ber Maim, and she saw the well. So there's a big shaila in the Mefarshim. Where was this well, and why didn't she see it before? So according to one shot is, it was a nay. Somehow the well, you know, the well just appeared now. Wasn't there before. But in the simple shot in the psukim, and I do believe there are some people learn this way, but I can't promise, is that the well was always there. But she just didn't see it. That's what's master from the Medrash. But the well was there. I mean, she just, a person sometimes, it's like a scary thought. A person has, she has a child dying of starvation, of thirst. There's a well of water right there. I don't see it. Why don't she see it? because she's attuned to not seeing it. She just wandered in the midbar, and she's looking and looking for water, and there's no water. And at a certain point, she gave up. She quits. So she's not looking anymore. So now the well's staring her in the face, and she don't see it. Because if you don't look, you don't see. There's a rule in life. If you don't look, you don't see. Right? So the thing could be right there. Maybe it was right in front of her. You know, she would have seen it. But it was seeable. If she would have looked around, you know, Maza, whatever it is, whatever you want to call it, she was walking and walking. There was no well. I give up. I can't take this anymore. Throws down the child and starts crying. But it happened to be where she stopped. If she just would have picked up her eyes and looked around, she would have seen in the distance there is a well there. It was visible. That's the sin. The Medrash says that there's a famous Medrash here that Omar Rabbi Binyamin, is it Rabbi Binyamin? I call Becheska Sumim. Is that one? That's in this week, on this parash. Some people say if you can't find something, you're supposed to say that Chazal, right? Right? It's just some kind of skula. What?
They say you also lose a little
or
something like that.
I don't know if he was. Okay, I don't know about that. Yeah, all right. But there's a chazal that's just, you know, you can't find it. It's there. You just got to open your eyes. Anyway, the Maisa, it's a scary thought that sometimes we get the opportunities are there. And it's not like we're taught. And the only thing, it just, we don't see it. Sometimes, I'll give you an example. I'm getting running out of time. But you go on a bus. And the guy sits down next to you. And he sees that you're Jewish or whatever. And he says that you're from. And he strikes up a conversation. Now, sometimes, obviously not all the times, sometimes there's a reason he's striking up a conversation because he's interested. Sometimes you have an extra neighbor who is told not from, and he wants to become from. And you don't notice the opportunity, right? So you just basically, I'm going to sleep. You give the guy a 2-minute answer and you go back, go to sleep, take your nap. No, you can't see it happening. Here's a guy you could have. If you would have realized the opportunity, you could have been Makari of this person. You could have made this guy from. There was a guy here in the yeshiva a few years ago. What was his? What's his name? I forgot. I'm very bad at names. I think one of the Yachnas boys was Makari of him somewhere. You know, when he was a single. You know, what was his name? You know, no. He lives in. He lives in East Boca. He's a lawyer. What, does anyone know? No. He used to learn here. Learned here for a little while. What? Maybe. Not Ethan, no. Okay, anyway. But this guy, you know, like, he met him somewhere on a bus or something. I don't remember the story. And he could tell. He was interested. He got him. You never know, but there's so how many opportunities like that happen where we had this like amazing opportunity that, you know, we could have been Mikari, this whole person, could have changed the guy's whole life, and we just were like, you know, hugger. You know, we don't see the opportunity. You know, we just blew it. Now, it doesn't mean this every time it happens, you have that opportunity. That's the problem. If every time you have the opportunity, then it'd be easy. The problem is that 9 out of 10 times, or 99 out of 10 times, we don't have the opportunity. Like by Hugger, 99 out of 10 times, she's looking around, and there's no water. But then, at some point, she just gives up looking, so when the opportunity really does come, she doesn't see it. So we're like that too. We're looking for the opportunity to do, how come I never get the chance to do big mitzvahs? Don't you ever sometimes feel that way? I used to always feel that way. I hear a story about this guy. He did this amazing mitzvah, right? He went ahead and saved someone's life. How come these things never happened to me? You know? Why does he get these great chances? He went ahead and met this guy and was mekarev him and changed his whole life. How come I never met a guy and mekarev and changed his whole life? How come there was a guy in Israel, his name was Rabbi Flam. Everything always happened to him. The craziest stories. It never happened to me. How come? So part of the reason is because he somehow saw it. And I don't see it. And I admit to it. We walk around with blinders. We don't see the opportunities. We're so used to the pennies, to the little things that when the big opportunities come, we miss it. So that's what Rav Shulman was trying. I think it was a very, that you have to train yourself to always keep your eyes open for the $1 million. And he didn't mean in money. He didn't even mean in fundraising $1 million. He meant that there's these, it could be once in your lifetime. I'm not promising there's always in your lifetime. It could be, you might only get sometimes the big opportunities you get once in your lifetime, but you can't miss it. I just want to end with a cute vart. It's not, I don't know if it's connected, but it's a little bit connected. And the Haftorah, it's from Rav Zaitchik. The story of the Haftorah? Anyone pay attention to the Haftorah this week? So this lady had a child that Elisha basically told her, and then the child died. So Elisha sent Gehazi. He gave Gehazi his stick, I think. And he told her, take my stick and put it on the child, and apparently that will revive the child. And it says that Gehazi went, and what happened? Did it work? No, didn't work. He came back to Elisha, said the child's dead, didn't work. So Elisha went ahead and brought the child back to life. So the shayla and the medrash is, Elisha obviously thought that with his stick, Gehazi could do it. He obviously put something. So how come it didn't work when Gehazi, Elisha thought it would work, so how come it didn't work? So there is a medrash that says, Moshe Lamad David Geza Melshel, that it says, not say Moshe, it says that Gehazi put the Koyach in the stick to be Mechai Mesim. Elisha put the Koyach in the stick to Mechai Mesim. But Gehazi didn't believe it. He thought, this stick can be Mechai Mesim. So when he was walking, he passed a dead dog. So he decided to try it out. So he put the stick on the dead dog, and guess what? The dog came back to life. But then, what happened? That was it. He couldn't use the stick anymore. He used it up. So he says, he gives a mashal. He says, a Hasidish story. That's what Rav Zaitchik quotes. That there was this person that came to the Rebbe. And he asked the Rebbe, he says, he needs a bracha. So the Rebbe, he needs whatever. His daughter needs a shidduch. He needs a bracha. So the rabbi gives him a bracha that the first thing you do, you should have tremendous, tremendous success. Okay? So he runs home and he tells his wife, hurry, give me my wallet. I have to go to the market. She says, wait, I want to hear what the rabbi said. He said, no, just give me my wallet. I have to go. He said, what is the rabbi? I want to hear what the rabbi said. And they get into such a fight. They never got into such a fight. And then, of course, he goes to the market and it doesn't work. He doesn't, because he used up the bracha, right? The first thing he did was he got into a fight with his wife. So the point is, what does that have to do with anything? Is that sometimes you don't have, the medrash, I don't know if that's the point, is you don't necessarily have more than one opportunity. It's not like life is full of, it could be in your, there are certain, I don't say, there's $1 million, a $500,000, The $1 million, the multi-million dollar opportunities, sometimes only come once. That's the scary thing. It's not like, you know, we go in, and I know in high school, I used to hate this. The Rebbe used to come in every day and say, for all those who weren't learning, today we're starting a new sugya, you can turn over a new leaf. So even if you didn't learn anything yesterday, we're starting fresh today. Right? Now that's a terrible message because, okay, I'll wait till tomorrow, you're going to also turn over a new leaf. So, you know, every day you come in. But in life, it's not like that. Sometimes you missed the opportunity, you missed it. There's only the multi-million dollar opportunity, the opportunity of saving the guy's life. You know, you only have one trick in that stick. And if you're not, and if you miss it, you miss it. That's it. So what getting back to what Rav Shulman said, a person has to keep his eyes open for that it might be once in a lifetime. Right? Esther, I don't know, you know, people have. But once in a lifetime, you know, there are, I could have been, you know, there were people that did amazing things, you know, with once in a lifetime. There was, you know, Shaya Cohn. Shaya Cohn's an amazing person. But who was Makariv Shaya Cohn? Yeah, I don't even know. I think Rabbi Kramer. I say Makariv, but he got to yeshiva. You know, like there are sometimes you get this amazing opportunity. If I would be Makariv Shaya Cohn, boy, oh boy. You know, there's this rabbi in the Rabbi Liff, you know, in Florida, right? You know, your people know. Left. So someone went ahead and the car, you know, like, you know, sometimes you hit the jackpot, you know? But you gotta be open. You gotta have your eyes open. Okay. That's it.